Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast, where we explore cutting-edge strategies to keep teams human-centered, drive innovation, and empower you with the tools and insights needed to help your team excel and thrive in today's rapidly changing world. Your host is Dane Groeneveld, a seasoned expert with over 20 years of experience enhancing team dynamics and innovation. Today, Dane is joined by Dr. Tina Ginaldo. Tina is the owner of Collaborate for Health. She is passionate about strengthening interprofessional teams to enhance team outcomes. Her mission is to empower the entire health team to work seamlessly together, fostering a culture of effective communication and collaboration. Tune in to discover. First, collaborative teamwork through science. Tina shares how she uses her 30 characteristics of team science as a tool to identify challenges within teams and make adjustments to improve teamwork. Second, teamwork training as a strategic investment. Tina emphasizes that teamwork skills consistently rank as a top corporate priority, making their development essential for fostering collaboration and achieving meaningful outcomes. And finally, patient-centered team leadership. Tina highlights the importance of empowering patients to act as leaders of their healthcare teams, enabling better advocacy and decision-making for their health journeys. So, teamwork makes the dream work, and we're here to inspire your next collaborative breakthrough. Gather your team or put on your headphones and let's dive in together.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Groeneveld, CEO of the Huddle 3 Group. And today I'm joined from New Orleans, Louisiana by Tina Ginaldo. Tina is the owner of Collaborate for Health. And we've been having a great conversation around the science of teams and teamwork. I'm glad to welcome you to the show, Tina. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dane. So I'm excited to be here, kind of talk about my story, why team science excites me, and how I think it really can be an asset to anyone, even if you're not a researcher, in terms of applying it to your daily work life to just make your teams work a little bit more smoothly and have fewer challenges.
No, I love it. It's going to be such a fun conversation. So before we dive in to some of those themes, maybe you could give our listeners a little bit of a backstory. You know, what is it that's kind of brought you to be doing this really cool work?
Yeah. So I'll actually start because I just recently listened to one of your podcasts. And one of the individuals talked about how she had lost her job, but then she came back and she was like, well, what's her why? And she said, I looked into my wallet to try to see like what memberships was I a part of. And I actually did that not too long ago, maybe about 2 years ago, not because I lost my job, just because I thought, you know, who am I and where am I going in life? And so maybe I'll introduce myself by that list.
Yeah.
And then talk a little bit about how I got into teamwork in this
that
area.
Sounds great.
So I like to say that I'm a child of immigrant parents here in the United States. I've been married for 25 years. I have 3 children. I have 5 best friends that range from 45 to 72. And I think that's a great range. I learn a lot from each one of them. I've been employed by 3 different employers. And so I think that says a lot to my consistency in my work and my dedication. I've been an educator since 2001, so quite some time. Formally in academia, though, since 2006. Throughout my 3 employers and my kind of 3 careers is what I like to call it, I noticed I was a program developer, so developing multiple programs in healthcare. So that is my area. I didn't say that earlier. I am a lifelong learner. I love to read, love to gather information on LinkedIn, and I have 4 degrees. And so that says enough.
That's a lot.
I don't want another degree. I just want to be my own lifelong learner and learn from who I want to when I want to. I am a researcher. I do have my PhD. So I have 1 textbook that I co-authored with 2 other wonderful individuals. I've published over 40 articles, not like huge amount like some of my peers, but I'm very proud of that in my time. And I have no problems presenting it and do that in a very collaborative way. And so I've presented everywhere, internationally, nationally, regionally, and have done it with, like I said, a lot of colleagues, because when I think about teams, you have to work collaboratively. And that also means sharing and disseminating the information that you learn in a collaborative way as well. And so that's me. And I mean, I think that's me in a nutshell. But what I would like to say about how I got into this work of teamwork, and you'll hear me use the word interprofessional collaboration a lot, or interprofessional education. And those are just terms that we use in healthcare. So it was somewhere around 2011 that I was in academia, and I had a colleague at the time who eventually is now one of my best friends. And she allowed me into her and her husband's journey related to healthcare. And he had a chronic disease. And this is where I learned that in healthcare, while we say we work in teams and we're very collaborative, sometimes that's just not the actions or the outcomes that patients and family members see. And so this is where it really hit home. I'm a physical therapist by training. So I was a provider before. I've been an administrator as well. And I always thought, you know, I'm very collaborative. I provide team-based care. But when I started to see the gaps in between individuals moving from a hospital setting to maybe a skilled nursing facility to a nursing home, back to home health, you could see the lack of communication amongst those settings, even though for the patient, right, it's their journey, it's their team, it's their healthcare team. Their healthcare teams are very dynamic. They do not have static members, but it's very difficult to collaborate across all of those different contexts. And so it was through that individual who introduced me to interprofessional education, which is a requirement. So in the United States, if you want to become a nurse, an audiologist, a dentist, a physician, a physical therapist like myself, it's required that those universities have some type of interprofessional education course. And in the United States, I say course, curriculum, but some kind of information. And in the United States, we've defined what interprofessional collaboration means. And so that's understanding one's roles and responsibilities, understanding how to work in teams and the science of teamwork, values and ethics regarding how to work in teams, and then how to communicate on teams. And so we've defined that within the healthcare space and how we should do that when we work between disciplines. And so when I say between disciplines, it could be between, you know, we would call it, I mean, I guess I shouldn't be that specific, but we would call it intraprofessional if you're talking about a pediatrician or a neurosurgeon. They're all physicians by training. There's just specialties. But interprofessional purpose, I can work with a physician and we can do so collaboratively on a team. But I think there's one thing that we all know that has happened or has occurred in healthcare, and probably, and still today there is this around, but this natural hierarchy in healthcare. But I think we see that in a lot of other settings. It's not just in healthcare. And so generally individuals will see physicians at the top. If you're thinking about an organizational typical chart, physicians would be at the top of that hierarchy. And then basically, I'm not even sure that it moves with the salutation of doctor, right? Because dentists are doctors in terms of their degree, chiropractors are, physical therapists are now. I think it's just a physician and then everyone else kind of falls on this other level. But we really talk about, when we talk about interprofessional collaboration, when I talk about teamwork collaboration, we know everyone has expertise in their areas and we respect all of those areas, but we have to remove the hierarchy in order to best serve the patient.
That's fascinating. I had no idea about interprofessional education.
No?
And yet the way you describe that, I'm like, why don't I know about this? That there seems to be so much depth and structure to it.
There is. And they've developed it. So in the United States, I will have to say this, the UK and Canada had interprofessional education way before the United States. But in 2011 is when the United States established their four competencies. And I believe if you remove the word patient, client, if you remove the word health or healthcare in those competencies and those subcompetencies, I believe any profession could use them, engineering, retail, business, because the concepts are the same in regards to what do we need to do in order to collaborate for the customer that we're serving.
No, I believe it. So you could, in theory, then take that material and contextualize it if you're serving a customer in a financial services industry versus healthcare, for example.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's neat. Well, I'll definitely do some more research there.
I'll send you the link.
That would be great. When you think about that approach, I know before we started rolling on the show today, you and I were talking about historically people have believed in all of these more like amorphous things that you do to build trust on teams and to create chemistry on teams. But it sounds like, you know, the science and the data is there to help you kind of go in and accelerate that team building mission, but then also to be able to monitor and tune as you go along. Maybe you could sort of dive into a little bit more there, Tina.
Yeah, so I will. So like I was telling you before, and I'll speak to it now in a little bit more detail. But around 2015, I took a role in academia where I was a director of what we called a centralized office for interprofessional education and collaborative practice. And so my role was to help develop, implement, and assess the curriculum that we would be using to teach our future healthcare workforce how to work on teams. And so in this particular institution, there were 19 different programs. And so we decided to bring those students together for a period of 2 years. So they would meet on a monthly basis and they would learn to work in teams. And, you know, you can, I think thinking back about when we were in high school or even maybe some of us in grade school and obviously in college, you had a faculty member or a teacher just put you together in a group and say, go do your group project. And most people did not like that at all. And that's because they asked you to do teamwork, right? They asked you to work together without teaching you how to work together. And if you went forward with that complaint, which everyone has done, I believe, you know, I'm doing all the work and so-and-so is not doing any of the work. And what would your teacher tell you? Well, just you go back and you deal with it and you figure out how to do it. But it's, we need to know how to do that. It's not something that's inherent in people's knowledge and their abilities and things like that. What would happen is that the one or two people would do all the work for the project and then the team would get the grade or the group would get the grade. So, but as I was diving more into the literature about teamwork, when we were creating this curriculum, I would, as a researcher, read a lot of articles inside and outside of the healthcare industry. And I would come up with these themes. I would write them down. So like, what exactly is this report saying? Or what is this article saying? And I will have to say this because I'm an educator. It wasn't all what we call peer review journals. I read Forbes. I read Harvard Business Review. I read anything that might not have references, right? So I read articles that were referenced, articles that were not referenced. But I jotted down these themes because I knew that all this information collectively together probably gave us a great foundation for teamwork. And I would remember reading things on LinkedIn that would say, here are the 5 traits of high performing teams, or here's 7 or 10. But by the time the years went on, so this is not something that happened overnight. It probably happened. I mean, it still happens today. But I would say that, I would say over a period of 3 years, I came up with 30 characteristics of what I call team science. And so it's not 5, it's not 7, it's not 10, it's 30. And the 30 shouldn't scare you though, because they're not rocket science. And so I think it is so important to keep these 30 characteristics, you know, on hand. I would say this to anyone new if I was coaching them and saying, keep these 30 characteristics as a checklist and then use them as you're developing a new team. So if you're starting a new team, really spend time trying to plan for goal development and just planning on how your team will communicate, how they're going to organize themselves and that type of thing. And don't miss that step. I do think that's a very important step. And if you do miss some pieces and parts in there and you don't take the time to do it, you'll see later on maybe why you have some challenges. So I tell everybody to use it as a checklist, look at it. If they don't like a checklist, then I kind of go back to music because I love music. And I would say, think of it as a DJ and all those little dials that they have on their box, right? And I always say everything starts in neutral. And then if you realize that you're having a challenge on your team, we'll dial that piece up. And then you don't have to keep it dialed up forever because your team will get exhausted. Then bring it back to neutral once your team gets over that challenge. But if you establish clear and measurable goals, if you develop a backup plan, so important to have a plan B. And I'll talk about that in a second. I'll let you talk too, Dane. But I have a great example of currently creating that backup plan. The one thing I think we don't do, we take for granted is we do not spend enough time. And time is critical during this initial phase. So spend the time to comprehensively plan and explicitly coordinate your steps and your process maps. And so this goes a lot into, you know, what I think other people think of when they think of lean or agile work, right? So this is nothing different. It's just pulling it all together. and making sure you have this well-defined sequence of how things will happen and whose roles and responsibility it will be. And then I think as your team comes together during that goal and planning phase, it's always good to think back and say, okay, what was the original purpose for us coming together as a team? And let's reaffirm that purpose. Has anything changed? And then now let's really reinforce our commitment to doing the work, because now the work, the action, right, the development of that plan really now comes together and requires us to also engage in teamwork. So I'll stop there to see if you have any questions or any thoughts, and then I can talk to you about an example of a backup plan, because I think it's so important.
It sounds cool. Yeah. And I've heard a lot about goal setting and roles and responsibilities in teams. And we've talked a lot about like working agreements, what we commit to each other by way of behavior or how we have tough conversations. But I've never really heard about backup plans. And I work in some fairly process intensive industries where there are, you know, very well documented procedures for locking and tagging out equipment before you work on them. So I'm really intrigued to know what this plan B looks like in a good case study.
Well, maybe it's a good case study. It's my case study, at least. So I'll tell you where maybe one of them started. It's a little bit fun, so it's not so sciencey. But in New Orleans, where I used to work, it was right across from the Superdome, which is the arena where our NFL team plays. And it's also where concerts might happen. But our curriculum that I would oversee was on a Monday night. And the Saints' schedule for football, if anyone follows pro football schedules, their schedules do not come out a year in advance when you're trying to establish your academic year. And so what would happen on a Monday night if the Saints had a Monday night football game? Sometimes the parking lots at the university would be rented out to visitors of the Superdome. But then also it's just chaotic in terms of music outside, people having a great time, and then our students having to park in parking lots and getting through that traffic. And so we would here plan this academic, you know, year, but what would happen if we couldn't be in person? Because we just wouldn't cancel class. You can't do that. You still have to develop you still have to deliver that content. And there is no other time to make it up when you think about it. Was for us, it was really big. It was 120 student teams, 1,500 students. So it's not just something you could go, oh, well, we'll just flip, put it in on another, you know, Monday at 1:30 or add another hour next time. It couldn't work like that. So when we didn't have on campus time, the backup was automatically to go to using a video platform. So whatever that video platform has been over time, and that changes as you have your institution maybe buying into new platforms, it's like, what's the backup plan? And the backup plans, we're still going to have class, but it'll just be via platform, you know, via video platform. And a case that I'm working with now is I'm developing a food pantry within our hospital setting. So in the United States, I know this is not about healthcare, but I think it's good to maybe give a little bit of context. But in the United States, hospitals are now required to ask about social drivers of health or health-related social needs. And so hospitals are required to ask their patients, do they have food security? Do they have any transportation needs, et cetera? Well, food security is one of those that a lot of our patients, we realize, don't have. And so we're going to be developing a food pantry. You have a plan of who's going to be asking your patients those questions, right? And so initially, it could be any, but at our particular facility, it was nursing. We're going to flip that a little bit now. But we're going to flip it to our patient experience representatives. But our backup plan is when those individuals are not there, someone calls in sick, something happens, life happens, who's going to be the backup? The backup will be nursing. And so while we really think that'll be less than 10% of the time, we know and we're going to identify within our process map who's going to be the backup when the patient experience reps can't ask those five questions to get the answer. And because we have the electronic health record, we can deem that area as required. And so it's going to be visually easy for nursing to see, hey, that these questions haven't been answered yet. So I need to pick up because this patient's about to be discharged and these questions haven't been asked yet. So we have a backup plan. It'll be in our process maps. It'll be in our education and our training. But it's, you know, if we weren't to ask those questions, one, it's a requirement. Two, you might have a patient who has a food insecurity that doesn't get the food that they need to go home with so they can heal. It's very important to be patient-centric or customer-centric when you're developing your backup plans.
That's super neat. And do you see that backup plan, and now you've explained it that way, you know, even I guess for, you know, particularly being down in New Orleans or Houston, you know, hurricane preparedness, how are we going to continue operations if a storm comes through? I know I've had friends that have had, you know, generators and plans to get to other parts of, you know, the state and to continue working, you know, if those storms are coming through. So it makes a lot of sense. Do you see that as one of these 30 characteristics that you're just checking and tuning in on, or is that more of a supporting system behind the characteristics that you dive into?
I call it one of the main characteristics. I really feel like it has to be something of a discussion because I say that in terms of your backup plan, because your backup plan might involve new team players, right? It might not be the people who are at the table, but you need to determine within that environment, who would it be? So it's a little bit falls into roles, depends on the process, right? Sometimes too, if you think about it, when you were just saying it, if the process is to, well, I mean, this happens right now when, I don't know, healthcare becomes hostage. We just had that over the summer, a major payer source. They became a hostage, right, to cyber attacks. And so what happens? Yep. Like, what's plan B? And we didn't have a plan B. And I don't even know in those cases, those major cases, could you have a plan B? But we can now, but I'm sure everyone in technology is trying to develop that plan B now, right?
Yeah.
Because they saw how detrimental it was in terms of healthcare services not being delivered because we didn't have that information that was being transmitted through all those platforms.
No, that's huge. That is huge. All right. And so diving into some of these other characteristics, that's a great practical example. You also mentioned goal setting. So if you're coming in and building a new care facility or a new team in a new market, goal setting is normally pretty clear because you're starting from scratch. But what about when you've got a team that's already intact? Are you going back in and sort of resetting, reestablishing, you know, starting with a blank canvas? How do you approach that from the learning syllabus and tools?
So I'll just speak about that because I'm a new team player at my new job. I've only been there for 7 weeks. And so I am joining existing teams. And so they're having to talk to me about the purpose of the team, why they initially started meeting, maybe now how has that evolved to something new or within some new goals. But when I think about goal planning, and because sometimes here, this is where you can have differences amongst your team. And it's great for everyone to share their perspectives. I always say this, is that when we share perspectives, those are our perspectives. But we also have to think about, like, why are we even establishing the goal? And it's probably for some type of customer, right? We're probably establishing this goal to meet the needs of our customer. So we need to always think about what are the needs of our customer. And I'll just say this now, because I do say this all the time. We need more patients on our teams. And they're active participants of their own team member. But when we're having the development of hospital teams and we're trying to improve patient safety or we're trying to improve patient satisfaction, I wish every hospital hired patients to be patient team members, not for their own healthcare, but for the voice and to advocate for what patients want in their healthcare. And this is like when I think about, you know, I mean, this is a silly example, but if someone were to develop a new TV or some type of screen or maybe, but why aren't your consumers who love to watch different types of TV, whether they're horror films or they're action or 3D, whatever, those individuals who are your consumers who are going to eventually buy those TVs, they should be active members of your teams. I think someone has a picture or a diagram on, and I'll say LinkedIn, just because that's the platform that I use the most to gather, to meet new team members. It's something like, so-and-so says that you should have an empty chair around a table because that empty chair is indicative of your consumer. And I just think you're short, like, why?
Too shallow.
Why would that chair be empty? We should be filling that chair with the person who we're developing the project or the goal or the product for. So I think I may have deviated a little bit for goals, but
that's fascinating. And maybe we come back a little bit deeper onto goals in a minute, but that position of the customer, it strikes me, I know with certain products or technologies, they often have like a testing team where they'll give it to customers early. I think Apple would normally give their new operating systems out to a key group of beta users get their feedback before they release to the greater public. So it does happen, but in a customer-centric organization, in a physical setting like a hospital, I guess the challenge is, you know, having customers wandering around behind certain areas is not easy. So I guess there's a lot more resistance and obstacles that you need to overcome to be able to bring that viewpoint and participation onto the team.
I think it might be difficult because of identifiers and privacy these days, but I still believe even in larger companies, if as they're building their product, I think you can always have people that you talk to about, like, why are you building the product? I think a lot of these larger companies do those types of outward surveys or have these interviews with individuals, like, well, what's missing in the, you know, in the old version? What should we have in the new version? And I think that might naturally come to them. But I think there's, like, I will say this, there's a, when you come together as a team and your consumer or your customers at the table while you're developing that potential process or that product that you know that would impact them, when they're at the table with you physically, providing their insight and perspective, it is so much more powerful to the team and understanding how they're going to utilize that process or product. It's very different when they're not there. You know there's a void, and sometimes you take your focus off of why you are there in terms of your purpose and in terms of healthcare, in terms of not being patient-centric. So you're not as patient-centric when the patient's not there in front of you advocating for themselves on how they would like to see delivery, right, of healthcare services. And I'm not sure if that's in other industries, but I would say maybe in a service industry, right, your hospitality industries, you would want your customer there with your teams giving their perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. But even if you think about internally, HR functions, we have a lot of listeners on the show that are in HR functions, they're serving two internal customers, managers as employers, and then employees who are being managed. And often when you hear some of the way that conversation happens behind closed doors about changes and process and change management, you can often be sort of going too heavily in one direction. So maybe there's benefit even in that setting to say, well, let's have a, we're not talking about union representation, but let's have, you know, a representative employee voice in here and a representative employer voice in here, and be thinking about the systems and goals that we're trying to set right now so that we don't run headlong into a painful change effort.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's great. I think about employee surveys. And so what happens? You get the voice of the employee through your surveys, but then who goes back and looks at the themes of those surveys? It's not the employees.
Yeah, they go, not at all.
Right?
No, you're
and
right.
Even so after, after you get the themes of your, whatever that employee survey says of your open-ended statements or your quantitative multiple choice statements, even in qualitative research, as here's my research brain thinking, when you do qualitative research and you interview your customers or you interview your, you know, individuals or your groups, you come back and then you gather your themes together. What were similarities? What were unique areas? And then you actually, in best practice, you give that back to them and say, so this, after interviewing, you know, these five people or these 100 people, this is what we saw resonated the most. And you actually ask the people you interviewed to confirm what you gathered. And I think that would be a wonderful piece for HR to say, we gathered all this information. We were able to kind of condense it into these three priority areas. Now, before we work on these projects, you know, employees or team members, do you think these are the top three? And just having that affirmation. And I think that's really important.
I really like that. I've never been a big fan of employee surveys, but I think you've just given me and the listeners a way to make better use of them, at least. And so going back to goal setting in a little bit more depth. So like if I come into a team, I've come into a few new teams in my past and come in and say, okay, guys, so what I'm hearing is that this is what we're achieving today, and we're going to set these goals for the next 3 years. We're going to lift sales, or we're going to enter a new market, or we're going to create a new service line or product. Is it very much at that level that you're setting goals to create more clarity around the why for people before you start changing things like marketing or ways of working or who's on the team?
Yeah. So when I think about the initial goals that are set on the team, I really see them as being more global in nature. I hope I'm answering your question. But there is a shared responsibility in terms of that goal setting. And so when, as a new team member, I'll just give it a recent example, because I think that's the best way to translate maybe what's going through my head, in that I gather together with my team. As a team within the quality department, we have to provide information about our area to new employees during new employee orientation. And we had the opportunity, because of some reorganization, to develop a new set of slides, right, that we would present during new employee orientation.
Yeah.
So we went through all of them. As a new team member, I sat back and I just listened, because I have a lot of listening to do and a lot of learning to do. But by the time we had our second meeting, I asked, I was like, what is the goal? Like, truly, what is our goal for new employees to know about the quality department? Because when they're in new employee orientation for 2 days, they're being hit with lots of information, and their job may not have anything that the quality people would probably say, Tina, don't say that, but their job may not have anything to do with patient safety. It probably does, but you know, or so, and I just said, what do we really want them to learn? So what is the goal again? It's not just to provide information at employee orientation. It's to provide information that we think is essential for them to know when, as they're going through employee orientation. And I think the biggest piece was that we just need to let them know that we have a quality department here, that we, you know, do X, Y, and Z. And if they need us at any point in time and they want to ask us a question, we're called the quality department.
You know,
I'm not going to say it's as simple as that, but I think when you think about, like, what is the goal? And their goal before was just to try to educate them on everything that they, not everything that they knew, but it was packed with information. And I just had to say, well, you know, guys, I just went through it and I can tell you what I remember from, you know, every single area. And I don't remember all the details, but what I do remember are these big things, and why is that important to me as an employee? And so I think it's knowing what the goal is as a new team member, definitely sitting there and listening and learning, but understanding truly what is your purpose, your true purpose, and then working backwards from that. Was that helpful?
Yeah, that's actually a really good description, because I get confused, particularly I've spent a lot of my life in sales roles. So goals are very much like metric driven or market driven.
They'll increase by 30%.
Yeah, exactly. But I love the way that you tie it into, like, what is the goal of our function or this onboarding session? And the way that you tie it to purpose there at the end really resonates for me, because we've been doing some work with a couple of our teams lately saying it's all good and well to have a company purpose or even a department purpose. But if you don't know what the purpose is of a new system that you're rolling out or the purpose of a new team member that you just hired, everyone's just guessing. And to your point with the quality department, you don't want to educate to a higher degree of fidelity, like, here's all the things that we do. You just want them to know enough about how to engage with you, and then you're going to drive more efficient teamwork and, you know, harmony there too.
Exactly. And then, you know, going back to goals, in that I think your processes are going to help establish your metrics, right? You know what your overall goal is that you want to achieve, but really when it comes to metrics, it's going to be more specific within your process that you develop that's going to help you achieve that particular metric.
Yeah, absolutely.
Someone might disagree with me on that, but I
actually think that metrics in the absence of a process can get lost and very easily be manipulated. So I think knowing the process allows you to really determine, first of all, that there is a control in place to ensure that when you go and audit that metric, the metric meets a certain standard or criteria. Otherwise, everyone's defining their metrics and finding their metrics from different parts of the organization or from different perspectives.
Yes.
No, that's really...
I don't know. I'm trying to think, you know, when metrics is... people always say this. I think I want to maybe speak to this for just a little bit. But when we think about metrics and teamwork, many people want to know, well, if I invest in training and teamwork, what is my return on investment? Am I going to have less retention? I mean, more retention. Am I going to have greater revenue? You know, why is teamwork training important? And I always say the opposite. And I would say, why is it not important? If that's pretty much the number one, it's in the top three every year of what corporate America wants their new employees and their current employees to do is work better in teams or have better cross-functional team collaboration. And if you don't teach them that skill set, how do you expect them to help you get a better return on investment, however you're going to measure that? And it's not going to happen overnight, right? It's going to be, oh, well, a project usually takes, like I have to say, sometimes I don't really talk about my accomplishments. I shy away from that. But I was just talking to my daughter earlier today and I said, so I started back on September 16th and by December 16th, I will have a food pantry open within our hospital system that's worked at the state level, that's worked at a community organization level, and that has worked with internal stakeholders. We will have gone through our site visit. We will have received our food and we will start giving out food to our patients in accordance to how we need to for our healthcare metrics, right? So there's some metrics in there too. And to be able to do that as a new employee within 3 months with all new team members is huge. And so when I think about the science that I use, I tell everybody it becomes a habit. I don't think about it as often, but when I really do reflect on, okay, Tina, why am I feeling like this week last week I felt a little bit challenged and I said, what's missing? And I actually took out my piece of paper and I said, okay, this is what it is. And I went back and I changed it this week. And you know, it wasn't That's a big awesome. Hiccup. It wasn't a big mistake. It was just, I was like, okay, things are not flowing smoothly. What is it? And I couldn't put my finger on it because there were so many moving parts. But when I did, I flipped the switch this week and it's done. It's not a problem anymore.
Yeah, that's powerful. And congratulations again for the food pantry in 90 days. Most people don't achieve anything in their first 90 days. And particularly when it comes to new change, it's all like onboarding and doing what's already done and learning the ropes. But to come in and implement new change is huge. It sounds to me there, Tina, as well, like the teamwork training, the goal setting, the knowing the purpose of a role or a new initiative, it helps create more, and you use the word collaboration very intentionally, but it helps create more sort of, it's more than collaboration that I'm looking for. It's almost like buy-in, support, unity. For getting stuff done. And given how many of our teams and organizations operate with this world of we know this much, but actually there's a much wider subset of reasons that things get done and way things that get done. You've got to think naturally that the more team members know what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it, the more people can give you a heads up as to, well, you're going to run into a roadblock over here because of this, or have you thought about that criteria? And so you're going to get sort of a collective intelligence, collective sort of traction behind those initiatives.
So if I even told you how many team players we had right now, I think it's over 11 departments to put on this food pantry. So pastoral care. I will tell you, I didn't even realize they weren't even on my original team member set. But after meeting with the pastor at the hospital, very clearly they're a team member of our food pantry. Of course, we have the quality department. We have case management. We have plant operations because when we get an 18-wheeler delivering food, 2,000 pounds of food, we have to figure out how to get that delivered and inside into our food pantry. You know, and every other team member that you would think probably should be on this, someone from finance, you know, someone from patient safety. I mean, just every patient experience too. So many different players. You realize how many individuals need to have a part of what you're doing in order for it to be successful. And I'm just going to say, I'll say one more thing about that. And you talk about buy-in and it's so important. And I realized this when I had the 120 teams and the 1500 students. As a leader, as a team manager, it's whatever your role is, you have to go to them. So we have, I think, over 14 different, I'm going to say campuses or sites.
Yeah.
I have to go to when we roll this out on an outpatient basis, I have to go to all 14 sites and I have to get their input and their buy-in before I develop the process. I can go in with somewhat about how I think it might work, but each clinic's going to work a little bit differently, but we can probably get our process to be about 80% the same and then allow for flexibility about 20% of the time. But I'm going to have to go to them. People will call that inefficient. It's not inefficient. I see it as taking the time to get the buy-in, to build the trust, so that when you are ready to implement the process, there is already buy-in, right? And so takes time on the front end with that planning, that explicit coordination, but really pays off in the end. And you know, when that process doesn't go as it's supposed to go, the clinic's going to, who are they going to call? They're going to call me. Hey, Tina, this quite didn't work out.
They know where to go.
Yeah. And they know where to go. And I think that's so important. And I'm not sure if that's leadership, team management. It's probably a combination of both.
It's both. Yeah. And I think some people get a little bit, in fact, I think everyone gets a little bit carried away with leadership. And one of my emerging beliefs from all of these great conversations I have with guests like you, Tina, is that there is a role of a leader in an organization, but then there is the practice of leadership. And I think great teamwork allows every member of the team, from whatever their role in, to practice leadership. And it's empowering, but it's also necessary, because like, work doesn't get done vertically in businesses. It gets horizontally done, like you said, 11 different departments to get the food pantry going. You know, the only way that happens is not through someone giving a big mandate from up above. It's having someone go around and do the leadership work to get everyone's buy-in and inputs and insight and support. So that's very cool. It actually raises sort of a final question that I had for you, Tina, which is, you know, in healthcare, there's a really big need. You mentioned it with your colleague's husband. There's a really big need to serve customers going through, you know, multiple different departments, experiences, interfaces, and they're busy places. There's a lot of, you know, regulation and safety and everything in play. How do you perceive kind of the emergence of themes like belonging and mattering in healthcare systems as a way of, you know, creating that connective tissue for those teams to really be knowing how to work together and knowing how to support their customers and allowing their customers to feel like, you know, they're really the center of attention and they're being cared for. It's not just people doing their own bit piece tasks.
Okay, well, that's a million-dollar question that I'm not sure that I can answer in, you know, in a short period of time. But what I think I can say is that we have to first have a shared mental model. We have to share this thought that our patients are leaders of their teams. They are leaders of their healthcare teams. If they choose and they want to give away that role of being a leader of their health team because they don't want to make the decision and they give that to their provider to make those decisions, then that's still a decision that the patient or the client makes. So first of all, I think we all have to see our patients as leaders, and we have to empower them to be leaders of their teams, because in a traditional sense, at least in the United States, this is not something patients usually seek advice, right, and care. They don't see themselves as probably leaders of their teams until they have to fight and advocate for themselves in very unfortunate situations. So I believe we need to do that. Second of all, is when it comes to the patient, we have all the right clinical skills. Everyone passed their national board exams. That's usually not the problem. Lifelong learning is usually not the problem. It's motivation. So is your motivation to serve, to still help the patient and care for the patient? And I do believe that in healthcare, and I think it's probably in a lot of industries, where we need to provide that support type of service to let healthcare providers discuss their feelings that they've developed, whether someone has, they've had a difficult patient, whether there was an unfortunate circumstance in that patient's journey. Maybe it was very joyous. I don't think we take the time either to really sit there and talk about the joys of healthcare. What we do is we see it in metrics. This hospital has a 4-star. This hospital's had 5 stars for 3 years now. What does that really mean? Yeah. And so it's a metric. And so for the healthcare team members providing care, I think we really need to do a better job within all healthcare facilities, not all, majority of healthcare facilities, really going through the debriefing process that teams should, and debriefing on positive outcomes, but also ones that we know there needs to be improvement. I hope that was succinct.
Brilliant answer. A brilliant answer. And I'd heard a lot about having to advocate for yourself, but I'd never heard it framed as the patient being the leader of their own team. And again, going back to your point on goals, like that's really powerful, because if you can bring a medical team together, cross-department or whatever else, and say, hey, one of our goals is to really empower our patients as the leader of their healthcare teams, you kind of know, going back to your point on like motivation to serve, you know, this is one of the things I need to do. No matter what my tasks are in the job, I need to really be living this and allowing this to kind of emerge and happen. So that's cool. And I love the second point you mentioned on feelings, because the one thing that I'm learning every day and week that I get older is that we've been brought up in a lot of our families and societies and organizations not to really talk about feelings, but actually they drive so much behavior. And you know, we can get pretty locked down if we're not really talking about those feelings, and it can manifest in some pretty negative and adverse outcomes. So I love the way that you bring that into the debrief too.
Perfect. Yes. If everyone can remember, look, what do I want everyone to remember from this podcast recording is that you need to learn how to be empowered to be the leader of your healthcare team. It makes a big difference when you can say, I selected my healthcare provider because of X, Y, and Z, not that I just accepted who was there or who was next. You might have to accept that person in an acute situation when you need some help. But afterwards, if that's not the person that you need to be on your healthcare team, take the time to find someone else. There's someone else out there for you. Yes.
Yeah. And I'll actually add to that, because I love this selected, not accepted. I think that's another gift, Tina. But that's true for your team too. It shouldn't just be the customer. Yes. It shouldn't just be the patient. But if you're a team member joining a healthcare system, you want to select the system based on how they work and, you know, the clarity they provide you, rather than just accept the job there. And I think put those two together and can have very different healthcare outcomes.
That's right. Powerful.
Very powerful. Well, thank you for your time today. There's been so many great points that we touched on, particularly around your sort of 30 characteristics of a team coming out of science. I love the kind of light bulb that you shone on into professional education and those kind of four key pillars there. So I look forward to diving into that a little bit more. The point that you raised around inviting the patient or the customer or the employee to have a seat at the table when we're designing some of these systems, processes, and changes was really cool. And that whole topic of ROI on teamwork training, you know, we know out there it's a gap everywhere. So let's just do it and you'll see the measures evolve later. But so many great points. If any of our listeners want to connect with you and learn more about your journey and the way that you're approaching teamwork through science, how do they find you, Tina?
I think the easiest way is to find me on LinkedIn. So Tina Ginaldo. And if not, I also have a website, collaborateforhealth.com. And so either way, just connect with me. I love to work with others. There's so much we can do together. And my tag is always, we are better together.
Love it. Well, thanks for your time today, Tina. It's been a blast.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us. Remember that by embracing vulnerability, trusting our intuition, and approaching challenges with compassion, we not only strengthen our teams, but also pave the way for a future where collaboration thrives. If you're hungry for more insights, strategies, and research on collaboration, head over to thefutureofteamwork.com. There, you can join our mailing list to stay updated with the latest episodes and get access to exclusive content tailored to make your team thrive. Together, we can build the future of teamwork. Until next time,